Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Three guests in two segments today. In moments, we'll hear from Yasha Levine, who will explain Ukraine's political structure in light of its recent presidential election. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll turn our attention to climate activism, the Extinction Rebellion movement that started in Britain and is now spreading around the world. First, Ukraine. On March 31st, Ukraine held a presidential election with 39 candidates. With a field so large, it was hardly a surprise that no candidate got a majority of the votes cast, so there was a runoff between the two top candidates on April 21st. Amazing idea, having to get a majority to win. We should try that here in the U.S. In that runoff, the incumbent president, Petro Poroshenko, who came in a distant second in the first round, faced the eventual winner, Vladimir Zelensky, a comedian with no political experience. Well, he did have some experience, sorta. He played an ordinary guy who became president on a TV show. And now he's the president-elect, having gotten almost three-quarters of the vote in the runoff. As with so many of these outsider figures from around the world, we have no idea what Zelensky plans to do in office. Despite a wave of popular support, he's going to face a deeply corrupt political structure and a rotten economy that will present him with immediate challenges. Here's the Russian-born journalist Yasha Levine with more. Ukraine has a new president-elect. Tell us about this comedian character.
He is 41 years old. His name is Volodymyr Zelensky. And he is the star of an extremely popular Ukrainian comedy show, which is kind of like a Ukrainian version of Veep, except instead of a very elite candidate, right, that's in the vice presidential office and is running for president, he plays just a regular guy, a loser, school teacher who's divorced, his wife hates him, and he goes on this rant against the government, talking about how corrupt it is, how it's controlled by oligarchs, how nothing matters, everybody's cynical, nobody wants to do anything, and this rant is videotaped by one of his students, it's posted online, and of course it goes viral, and this just random guy gets elected president. That's the premise of the show.
Now it's real.
And now it's real, and basically he ran as the guy on the show, and the guy on the show is this just, you know, a very well-meaning history teacher, talks a lot about Greek democracies and things like that. And, you know, he's a kind of a populist politics, it would be somewhere like a populist neoliberal. And he is just wants to, you know, tackle corruption. He wants to tackle sort of this bloated government that is like a feeding trough for oligarchs, for bureaucrats, and, you know, for all these sort of clans that rule Ukraine. And he goes into the government and, you know, is like this humble servant of the people and tries to reform it. And so he essentially ran as that guy. And it's interesting to see him win, but it's actually not that surprising because he is a kind of a good character. He's like an everyday man, you know. He's clean, he's young, he's good looking, he's pretty fit, and he wants to reform the country. And given how totally messed up Ukraine and how just almost, you know, it's just, it can't get out of the cycle of oligarchic politics and corruption and election scandals and overthrows and putches and things like that. Like, he is obviously like the only option. So in that sense, he's almost like a Trumpian figure, although he doesn't come with the negative baggage that Trump came with when he ran for president.
This is, of course, a phenomenon we've seen around the world, elsewhere, Italy, Iceland even, of these outsiders with vague politics, winning election on a promise to clean up the filthy stables. What, if anything, does this guy stand for?
It's not really clear. He ran this very opaque campaign where he wouldn't do too many interviews. His policy positions or his platform was also very vague and almost non-existent. The things that he kind of represents and he talked about are he wants to, of course, fight corruption, and he wants to lower living costs for Ukrainians because after the 2014 putsch that took out President Viktor Yanukovych and sort of replaced him with this guy named Petro Poroshenko, cost of living in the country has gone up incredibly. The government, under pressure from the IMF and from the EU, canceled a lot of the government subsidies for electricity and other common things that people pay for. And so the cost of living for regular Ukrainians has just hit a point where it's unaffordable. And so that's something that he's sort of said that he wants to address, that he wants to lower the living costs and return some of these subsidies to people. He promised to somehow end the conflict in eastern Ukraine and to come to some kind of agreement with the sort of separatist rebels that control the eastern part of the country and have like about 15% of the population under their control. And of course, those separatists are backed by Russia. So it's part of this Ukrainian-Russian conflict. And he promised to somehow end that civil war and to come to terms of it. But it's not clear how he would do that. That's kind of it. One thing that he was also for is he represented a kind of a more moderate nationalistic stance. So he didn't run on this campaign of Ukrainian nationalism. He himself is a Russian speaker, and he doesn't speak Ukrainian very well. And he sort of represents the Russian ethnic side of the Ukrainian political divide. And so he promised, just by virtue of who he is, to be a kind of a less nationalistic, which is implicitly more pro-Russian or more pro-ethnically Russian candidate. Because the previous president that he replaced, you know, had this very, very ultra-nationalist, almost fascist platform that he ran on. Used all of these old Ukrainian national symbols and really pushed through all these glorification of a lot of Ukrainian fascists and Nazi collaborators as part of his kind of repertoire of what it means to be Ukrainian and what it means, what Ukrainian identity means. And so this new president avoided that as much as possible. And so he represents this much more moderate nationalistic perspective on what it means to be Ukrainian.
Zelensky is Jewish, and he defeated by a very wide margin this guy with all these Nazi supporters. The Ukrainian government has been populated with some Nazis. The political structure is full of folks like this. So what about the Jewish guy winning? Does that mean that the Nazi force in Ukraine is exaggerated? What do you make of it?
No, I don't think it means that the Nazi force in Ukraine is exaggerated. I mean, I think it's a great thing, and it shows that for the majority of Ukrainians across most regions in Ukraine, you know, being Jewish is not something that prevents them from voting for you, right? Especially when you're running against an extremely unpopular president. You know, his popularity levels of the guy that he's replacing, I mean, are just, I mean, if they could be negative, I think they'd be negative. So it doesn't preclude people from voting for him, his Jewish identity. But the problem is that sort of this fascist resurgence and this far-right resurgence in Ukraine is something that's been going on really since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And it's this kind of political project that has been kind of growing in waves and waves and waves. And in 2014, it reached a whole new level of dominance and acceptance in Ukrainian society and how it was used by oligarch clans in the country as a political tool to mobilize people, you know, against Russia. On a structural level, these far-right groups and these far-right activists and politicians who are very much embedded in the government right now, they're not going to go anywhere. And in fact, you know, the fact that it's a Jewish president is being elected could pose, you know, serious problems for Jews in Ukraine if things start to go really badly in Ukrainian politics. If the economy starts going poorly, if the war heats up, or if he's seen as kind of weak and capitulating to Putin, his Jewish identity might be used against him and will be used against him by more of the nationalist wing of Ukrainian political structures and be used to say, like, look, told you, you know, here's another a Jew controlling Ukraine and blaming all the problems that Ukraine is facing and are going on this Jew that's in power. You know, in Ukraine, nothing is ever black and white. There are no clear lines that people in the West like to kind of impose. And so on the one hand, the election of a Jewish president is a great thing, and it shows that the majority of the people in Ukraine are not anti-Semitic to the point that they're not willing to vote for someone because of their Jewish identity. On the other hand, his Jewish identity was not really central to the campaign. He didn't talk about it. It wasn't, you know, central to it. Only his detractors used it against him. But also, we have to understand that the far right and nationalism has been growing in the country, and it's not going to stop growing just because a Jewish president was elected. I mean, just to give you a sense of how integrated the far right is in Ukrainian politics, the speaker of the Ukrainian Rada, which is the Ukrainian parliament, who is one of the most powerful politicians in the country. He's second in line to the presidency. If something happens to Zelensky, this guy would come to power and he would be serve as interim president. This guy's name is Andriy Parubiy, and he is a straight-up Nazi that took off his Nazi uniform and put on a suit and stopped doing the Heil Hitler salute, but talks about democracy and, you know, patriotism, but that hasn't really changed any of his values. This guy started the Social Nationalist Party of Ukraine, which is a kind of Nazi-inspired political party. He led a fascist paramilitary in Western Ukraine, and he became one of the biggest and most prominent leaders in the 2014 protests that ousted Yanukovych. And so this guy is now second in line to the presidency and is essentially kind of the chairman of the parliament. And that's just sort of the very, very top level. You have far right and fascist activists and politicians in security branches of the government, in overseeing cultural institutions that fund cultural programs that give out grants to fascist and far-right organizations around the country. You have these kinds of people in the police departments. And, of course, by some accounts, 10% of the parliament in Ukraine is made up of far-right or fascist or sort of white nationalist activists and politicians or people who are linked to those groups. The election of a Jewish president doesn't change all that because these groups are very useful to the oligarchic structure of the country. They're used as muscle. They're used to resolve business conflicts. They're useful for beating up and chasing away protesters or, you know, environmental activists or left-wing activists in the country. These fascist groups are very, very useful to Ukraine's ruling elite, and so they're not going anywhere.
Yeah, let's talk some about that elite. Who are they? How many of them are there? And that's the base for this kind of fascist politics.
Ukraine is tricky because Ukraine is an oligarchic system. It's like this. There's this kind of oligarchic pluralism. So you have these oligarchic groups that morph all the time. They don't stay constant. There's alliances that are formed. They break up and they reform. But they are kind of regional, and they're tied to this kind of split identity Ukraine has and the Ukrainian society has. We have to remember that Ukraine is kind of like two countries because the central and eastern part of Ukraine have been for hundreds of years under the Russian Empire. And the western part of Ukraine was under Austria-Hungary. And then after World War I, they were under Poland. And only Stalin was able to unify Ukraine and make it kind of this modern state that it exists today. When the Soviet Union and Hitler partitioned Poland. After that, like, basically Stalin took that chunk of Poland that Western Ukraine is today and gave it to Ukraine and made this modern Ukraine joining East and West for the first time in the history of Ukraine. Ukraine, as it exists today, only goes back to the Soviet Union and the creation of Stalin, essentially. And there are regional differences between these two Ukraines. These regional differences are also used in the political struggle between these oligarchic clans. The eastern part of Ukraine is more ethnically pro-Russian. The western part of Ukraine is more ethnically, quote-unquote, Ukrainian or Western. There are religious differences between these regions as well, and linguistic differences and cultural differences. The kind of the fascist and the sort of the far-right identity of Ukrainian nationalism comes from the western part of Ukraine, from movements that were fighting for Ukrainian independence from Poland, and had allied with Nazi Germany and essentially served as a kind of a avant-garde advance force when Nazi Germany launched its invasion of the Soviet Union. They went into Ukraine and administered parts of Ukraine and served in its Nazi police divisions and SS formations. And so these Western Ukrainian nationalist organizations form kind of the national identity of Western Ukraine. So certain oligarchic clans use that identity and use that in their fight for power and in their struggle against other oligarchic clans, which are more pro-Russian, if that can be sort of easily explained. I don't know if that's confusing or not.
Well, it sounds like the underlying material is quite confusing.
Yeah, it's very confusing because, look, you have these oligarchic clans and alliances, and a very potent weapon of Ukrainian identity are these sort of nationalist heroes and nationalism. They're used in that political fight.
I'm speaking with the journalist Yasha Levine. These sound like deep, deep fissures that a presidential election cannot really address. So what kind of regime are you expecting out of Zelensky?
It's a good question. Nobody knows. I mean, what we know about Zelensky is that he is closely tied to one of the clans that exists in Ukraine, clan that sort of originates in central Ukraine and headed by this guy named Ihor Kolomoisky, a banking oligarch who owns TV stations and is involved in all sorts of other things. The TV station that produced and aired Zelensky's comedy show, Servant of the People, is owned by this oligarch, and it is rumored and it's widely believed that Kolomoisky is kind of backs Zelensky. Kolomoisky has had a falling out with the current president of Ukraine, Poroshenko, who is also an oligarch. He's an oligarch known for his candy and chocolate empire. And so these two oligarchs have kind of had a falling out. They've had conflicts over like divisions of businesses and control over state enterprises. And so, you know, the kind of the cynical observers of Ukraine see Kolomoyskyi is backing Zelensky as a presidential candidate as a way of kind of coming back to power and regaining supremacy in Ukraine and ousting the current oligarch president. One thing that we can expect most likely is that the oligarch clan controlled by Kolomoyskyi, who is himself Jewish, is going to see its fortunes rise with the election of this president. But what can change? You know, but the problem is that there's the president and then there's also the parliament. And the parliament has a lot of power in Ukraine. And so the question is, what is the makeup of the parliament going to look like in the upcoming elections? Who is Zelensky going to be making deals with? What are going to be some of the strategic alliances that he makes? And that's not clear. I mean, it's going to be very difficult for him to end the war with Russia because he's going to have a lot of pressure from Ukrainian nationalist groups that are very powerful and actually can mobilize a lot of people and can get really violent. Any deal with Russia that is seen as favoring Russia or seen as capitulating to Russia is going to be very, very hard to make. It's also going to be very hard to make any kind of reforms in the economy and some of the subsidies that have been taken away from the Ukrainian economy because the cancellation of these subsidies are written into the deals that Ukraine has made with the IMF. He's going to be in a very difficult situation. I'm not sure how much room to maneuver he's actually going to have. For most people, it's sort of up in the air. There's a possibility that something good will come out of it. Even the most cynical observers who don't believe that any change can come in Ukraine because of this oligarch-dominated system are still hopeful, but are very cynical as well and know that most likely nothing will change for the better.
What about relations with Russia? How does Putin seeing this?
It's not clear. You know, I think Putin is, I believe, didn't even call to congratulate him, the new president. Russia would like to end this conflict in some way that's favorable to it, but it's not clear what it means. Look, Ukrainian president cannot be seen as capitulating to Russia because it'll have a wide blowback in Ukrainian society. And so I don't know what he can do with it. And I think Russia is kind of taking a wait-and-see approach with Zelensky, you know, in the same way that Russia took a wait-and-see approach with Donald Trump.
And then what about the EU?
Well, I think, the EU has been supportive of Zelensky. I think Zelensky came as a shock to the European Union because his win, right, this nobody comedian who has no political experience, has no political platform, came out of nowhere and really won because he's like the fresh face and the most well-known face of 30 or so candidates that ran for presidential office. He came out of nowhere, right? He surprised everybody. And the overwhelming support that he received, I mean, he received 73% of the vote. In some regions, it was over 80% of the vote, was a clear rejection of the previous president and the previous administration. And the previous administration has seen, you know, was basically backed by the EU and backed by America. This was like a kind of a project for the EU, for NATO, and for America. And so it was a repudiation of everything that the EU was trying to achieve and sort of the face of the EU programs and the face of European integration, right, of Ukrainian-European integration. And so I think the EU is, although it's like, you know, accepting Zelensky and it's accepting this transition to power, I think to a lot of the people who are, you can see it even online, you know, people are freaking out about the fact that Zelensky won because it's a clear rejection of everything that they've been kind of pushing for the past 5 years.
I think the record of all these outsiders, the comedians and such, has not been very inspiring. So one's expectations for what Zelensky would produce seem rather low.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are structural issues in the Ukrainian society that Zelensky does not address, right? I mean, he is supported by an oligarch in a political system where oligarchs dominate completely, where it's actually kind of a managed democracy for oligarchs, where they kind of have these elections, they put up candidates, people vote for them, you know, a new candidate comes into power promising, you know, the world to the electorate and never really doing anything, never really delivering on anything, but continuing this very corrupt system that is kind of like, if you imagine that, you know, Ukraine or Russia had never emerged from like the Yeltsin's oligarchic kind of Wild West days. That's kind of what Ukraine is today. You know, it's sort of evolved into a stable system like that, where you have all these different oligarchic clans vying for power. And so Zelensky doesn't change the underlying structural, you know, makeup of this political system. He's kind of an example of it and a rejection of it, right? But at the same time, he is a part of it. And so I think, you know, voters in Ukraine would know that he is tied to an oligarch, yet like there are no other options. You know, what are you going to do? You exercise your vote, and you have these options, and then you know the guy gets elected, and hopefully he People hope that he does something. But given the track record of Ukrainian elections, the chances of any kind of serious reforms or the chances that he will actually change the underlying oligarchic structure of the state and of the society is very unlikely. You can't fight corruption without getting rid of the oligarchy that is basically the cause of this corruption. He's kind of in for, I think, a pretty tough run as president. And it'd be interesting to see how he deals with it. He's kind of run on this very almost virtual campaign where, you know, he's never really talked to people. And so it'd be interesting to see.
Life is TV show. Maybe he'll have to go back to the TV.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe he won't be so funny when he comes back after getting bruised as a president of Ukraine, you know, an extremely unstable and dangerous society. One of the presidents got poisoned by this really kind of, and he was completely disfigured. Yushchenko, the president of Ukraine, the one who led the Orange Revolution. You know, what's interesting about Ukraine is that, like, there's been kind of this football that's been going on between pro-West, sort of Western Ukrainian and Eastern Ukrainian, and pro-East candidates. Right, so every election, it's been a handoff. On the one hand, you have a pro-Western candidate win. The next election, 4 years later, you have an Eastern candidate win. That's been going on basically since the beginning of Ukraine after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And this election actually keeps in with that pattern. Pyotr Poroshenko represented the Western Ukraine, sort of a Western integration, and you know, all the good things that integration with the West promised, prosperity, kind of European values, European standards, you know, making Ukraine, if not Sweden, then maybe Poland or maybe one of the Baltic states. Those are the promises of the West. And of the East is sort of like stability, getting what you know. These two things vie for power, right? These two sides. And they hand off power one to the other, kind of almost like, you know, Republicans and Democrats handing off power to each other. This election is just a continuation of that. Zelensky represents a kind of more Eastern pro-Russian or moderately pro-Russian, pro-ethnically Russian stance. And he won. Nothing really changed. These patterns of regional power structures kind of handing up power to one another because they totally discredit themselves in the 4 years that they're in office. And so people just reject them in the next election. Right. And so it's the same thing now with Pyotr Poroshenko. He promised all these things about European integration. Couldn't deliver on any of them. And in fact, the country got more corrupt, poorer. And so people reject that and go with a kind of a slightly more moderate, you know, version of it, which is less Western, more Eastern, more pro-Russian candidate.
That was the Russian-born journalist Yasha Levine. After we recorded this interview, Vladimir Putin laid down a test for the incoming president. He's offered Russian citizenship to several million residents of breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine. The exact number is unknown. This is clearly a move towards incorporating those regions into Russia. But as Yasha pointed out, Zelensky can't afford to look soft on Russia, so he's going to have to figure out what to do pretty quickly. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the chaconne from Bela Bartok's Sonata for Solo Violin, performed by Isabel Faust. Next, Extinction Rebellion. Extinction Rebellion, abbreviated XR, is a political movement that got going in Britain about a year ago. Its aim is to use civil disobedience to attract attention to the climate emergency and disrupt normal life enough to force serious action to avert absolute disaster. What are they doing exactly, and what is the strategy? We'll get views on this from both sides of the Atlantic, first from Rupert Reed, who's with the original British movement, and then from Ashley Sanders, who's on the outreach team of its New York branch. Rupert Reed teaches at the University of East Anglia and has been, as he says, involved with XR since before its launch. So first, just a history of Extinction Rebellion. How did it get going and when?
So Extinction Rebellion was launched last autumn when a load of us turned up at Parliament Square and just walked into the street and held a meeting in the street, which I emceed part of. Caroline Lucas and George Monbiot spoke to us from a soapbox in the middle of the road. I was lucky enough to have the chance to eulogize Greta Thunberg, who came and gave us her support. It was a fantastic, extraordinary day. And that was the beginning. Then a month later, we occupied 5 bridges in central London and 6,000 people undertook civil disobedience. And now, of course, this is the actual rebellion. And it's been pretty amazing so far. I think it's exceeded most people's expectations. I'll be honest with you. It certainly exceeded even mine.
So how many actions have you had so far?
Oh, God. I mean, you can't even really answer that question anymore. There's just one thing after another now. It's constant. Since the start of last week, so that's 8 days, we've had 1,200 arrests here. This is now the biggest nonviolent direct action movement in the history of Britain, or at least certainly of modern Britain. And it's proving really quite fascinatingly successful in some striking ways. And our hope, obviously, is that this success will be an inspiration to Extinction Rebellion activists and others who are similarly aligned, such as 350.org in the States, to do something similar to what we've done.
Well, I just interviewed somebody with the New York group, and it does seem to be spreading here and beyond. So
yes,
quite a dramatic few months.
Yes, I just visited America on work, and I met with Joanna Macy, who's very supportive, and I met and had a very cordial debate with Bill McKibben, who's super supportive. And I met with some people from XR Philly, and they're a very impressive bunch. And, well, as I say, our great hope here is that what we've managed to do here will inspire people around the world to do the same kind of thing, and perhaps America will be the next place where it really happens big.
So what's the strategy? What is your intention and the long-term plan?
So the basic idea, as with all nonviolent direct action, is to create action dilemmas for the government. So what are they going to do? Are they going to crack down on nonviolent protesters, or are they going to let these protesters reclaim space indefinitely, or stop economic activity or governmental activity indefinitely? And it's obviously been quite awkward for the government and the mayor and the police here in London over the last 8 days. We've sometimes had the sense that the heart of the police isn't really quite in this. We are very aware in Extinction Rebellion that the police have children too, and that they're worried about the future too. And we think that that's one reason perhaps why sometimes the police haven't seemed to be 100% behind the idea of stopping us from doing what we are doing. So we've been occupying public space. We've been occupying Marble Arch, which is a big road intersection, the same at Oxford Circus. We blocked Waterloo Bridge and turned it into this wonderful kind of garden bridge with plants and so on. And we occupy Parliament Square right at the heart of power. And meanwhile, we've been doing other more radical things. So, for example, my colleague Farhana Yameen, one of the negotiators of the Paris Climate Accord, who's now more or less given up on that process, she took direct action against Shell and glued herself to the Shell HQ. We had an action against part of the underground network here the other day. That was controversial. People said, why are you targeting public transport? And my response was, look, it's very simple. If we knock out one line for a few hours, it makes a very, very powerful point about the fact that climate change is poised to knock out all underground lines for all time if we don't get it under control. Sea level rise is going to hit cities like London and New York and Philadelphia very hard, and take out the underground systems, the subway systems, unless we get control of it. So that gives you hopefully a bit of a flavor of what we've been doing. We really have absolutely revolutionized the climate debate in this country. I'm not exaggerating. Within 8 days, it's absolutely transformed, and I can tell you more about that if you want.
Just a quick question. I noticed that gluing oneself to spaces is a popular tactic. What's the intention behind that?
Rather than chaining themselves to things, quite a lot of our activists are gluing themselves now, which is obviously quite a drastic thing to do and, you know, very slightly dangerous, obviously. It takes quite a long time for police and medical services and so on to unglue somebody. It's not very pleasant. I've seen some of my friends with the super glue scars on their arms and so forth. You have to be committed to do it, but it is quite an effective way of shutting something down. So, yeah, that's why a bunch of us have been doing super gluing ourselves to things.
theorists of social rebellion, like Fran Piven, argue that the way to accomplish real serious social change is to disrupt the operations of society to the point where it makes it very difficult to reproduce itself in a normal way. Is that what you're intending to do, or is this just an attention-grabbing scheme?
Oh, no, it's very much the former. The key theorist of our movement in that regard is perhaps Roger Hallam. That's very much his argument, that we're making it very difficult for anything like business as usual to go on. And that makes a point in itself about how business as usual should not go on. But it also really draws the attention of everybody, including, of course, government. And as I say, they are then placed in the position of these awkward action dilemmas in terms of trying to decide how they handle this.
And then how have you transformed the climate debate in a matter of weeks?
Less than weeks, you know, literally 8 days. The first couple of days, we made a huge impact, but obviously there was a lot of the negative press, and some negative press has continued. But what's massively changed is that the number of people supporting our aims, which, remember, are incredibly radical, they include Britain carbon neutral by 2025. We now have a majority of the population in an opinion poll saying they support our aims. We have a former leader of the Conservative Party writing in the Conservative sort of home newspaper, The Telegraph, that the Conservatives risk being completely left behind if they don't get serious on the climate issue. We have the Confederation of British Industry come out this week and say Extinction Rebellion are asking all the right questions. We've had massive questions in Parliament. Greta Thunberg has been here. She's been strongly supporting us. And she was instrumental in helping us to nail down the meeting with government ministers that we're going to be having next week. They had been saying before that they wouldn't meet with us until after our rebellion was over.
Now, you mentioned one demand, that Britain be carbon neutral by 2025, which I believe your American counterparts are also making their demand here. But, yeah, what else? What's your agenda?
Well, so the first demand is tell the truth. We want government, we want media, we want everyone to tell the truth about just how bad the ecological crisis in general and the climate crisis in particular are. And including, of course, very, very crucially, the biodiversity crisis, which is, of course, an extinction crisis. And that demand, we think, is very, very powerful and central and foundational to everything else. The second demand is the eye-watering carbon neutrality by 2025 demand. And the third demand is that how to get there won't be decided by us. It'll be decided by the people. We're calling for citizens' assemblies to replace or supplement our broken democracies, and for those citizens' assemblies to determine, with the help of expert advice and through processes of deliberation, to determine how to get to the stringent targets that are needed.
People who face climate change as an issue look at something that just seems so overwhelming. I know I have this reaction myself. I said, okay, I know it's really terrible, but I can't think about it really now because it's just too much to think about. So, you know, the impulse is to turn away and not really think about it. Or think, you know, it's something we can do in the future. It's a really long-term threat. It's something we don't need to worry about right now. I have more pressing demands. How do you deal with that psychology in the broad public?
What I'll say to that now, Doug, is that my feelings, my views on this have changed just in the last few days. You know, I've been someone who's been giving talks for the last couple of years about how desperate our situation is. I've been feeling very hopeless, as many people have, many of them secretly and some people openly. But that's kind of changing. The last few days, I've been daring to start to hope again. I've been thinking, my God, this huge transformational change that we've been talking about and hoping to be able to hope for, it seems now as though it just might start to be happening. So something I really want to say in all sincerity to American listeners is you cannot overestimate what's changed here and how quickly it's changed. Look at what we've done and think about how you can in some way replicate it. And maybe that involves a similar kind of scale of protest in Washington, D.C., or in New York City, or perhaps it involves it in every state capital or in some state capitals. And maybe that's actually going to completely change the agenda. So in other words, in answer to your question, I would say getting involved with Extinction Rebellion and having actual success, the kind of remarkable success that we've had, that can actually transform one's attitude. And a lot of people here have been very, very moved because they're starting to feel maybe it isn't hopeless after all.
What do you attribute this change to? Is it Extinction Rebellion itself, something in the times? Did you just catalyze something that was lurking or what?
So I think it's a complicated picture. I think that one crucial thing is the appalling weather chaos, which of course is climate chaos of the last few years, has been waking a lot of people up. Greta Thunberg and the climate school strike movement has been a huge catalyst, and Greta has been a huge supporter of ours. She's been very, very important. And then the final element is ourselves in Extinction Rebellion, because I think it's crucial that you get all of that kind of change in people's mindsets that is happening, and you turn it into action. And not just any action, not just political action through the existing system, which is necessary, absolutely crucial. Sunrise Movement is playing a key role there. Not just, obviously, individual action, not just the kind of action that NGOs have been taking for years, but this kind of action, direct action, coordinated, intelligent, strategic, non-violent, direct action of the kind that we've been doing in London. I believe that if you were able to copy that in the States, you could have the same transformation that we've had here. I want every listener who is at all convinced by this to look into getting involved and making it happen.
Okay, what do you got planned for the coming weeks and months?
Well, that would be telling. But I will tell you that there's going to be some pretty full-on actions coming in the next few days. Next week, we're going to be meeting with the government. We're going to be pausing the rebellion for a while after that. But we are likely, unless the government makes really dramatic changes of the kind that obviously we're hoping they're making, but not expecting, we will probably then be back in a few months' time, or maybe in as little as 6 weeks' time, setting the pace again.
That was Rupert Reed, a leading activist in Extinction Rebellion in Britain. And now a view from the U.S. Ashley Sanders is a writer and is on the outreach team of XR in New York City. In the interview, she refers to a lawyer who committed suicide in Brooklyn's Prospect Park to draw attention to the climate crisis just over a year ago. His name was David Buckle, and he had a national reputation as a defender of gay and trans rights. Ashley Sanders. So let's start with a bit of history. How did Extinction Rebellion get rolling in New York City?
So in New York City, we were really inspired by the Extinction Rebellion movement that was growing in the UK. You know, some climate scientists, academics, and activists came out saying, we're not doing enough, we have to act now. And they occupied 5 bridges in London and forced the mayor into more sweeping climate action and climate commitments. And so we thought, well, you know, Trump's removed himself from the Paris Climate Accord in our whole country. We have to take even more radical sweeping action than other countries because of that. So we need to do something big.
What time was this? When was this happening?
This was just last year. This was just about 6 months ago. And around that same time, a lawyer committed suicide, self-immolated in Prospect Park, calling attention to the issue of climate change and said, you know, we have to act now. We have to do more than we've ever done.
I remember that. Actually, a friend of mine was running in the park that morning and, you know, ran across the whole scene. And it just passed. I mean, this guy, like, burned himself, tried to draw attention to the problem. And I don't know, it seemed like it just happened and then people forgot about it. But evidently it did have some influence on you and your colleagues.
Yeah, I think a lot of people did forget about it, and I think that was part of the tragedy, is that somebody can be disconcerned by the facts and that so many of us can just go on our merry way. And so some of the, you know, people who founded Extinction Rebellion in New York City, I think were very, very affected by that. I wasn't part of that original group, but they said, you know, for the sake of this man and the message he's trying to get out, because of the climate facts and because we are so inspired by what's happening in the UK, we want to bring this to New York City and to, you know, to the United States' biggest city and see what we can do here to push the conversation further.
What actions did you start with?
So we started with a die-in and a demonstration action at Rockefeller Center. We marched to Rockefeller Center, and I, include along with about 15 other people, skated onto the ice rink and then did a die-in in the shape of the Extinction Rebellion logo, which is an hourglass, to, you know, call attention to the fact that time is rapidly running out for us to take climate action. And then up above on the higher level, people did a die-in to demonstrate how different areas of the world would be affected by mass climate change. People blocked roads along Fifth Avenue carrying banners, and one of our group actually climbed onto the Prometheus statue and draped a banner that said climate change equals mass death. So that was kind of our debut action. We had about 400 people out, and then, you know, lots of news coverage, lots of people watching, people just going about their business, ice skating and walking around, you know, in a really busy part of New York. And that was our goal, was to really, we want to do dramatic, disruptive actions to get attention and to help people turn from bystanders saying, okay, I guess this is normal or this is the new normal, to upstanders, people who are actually say, you know, this isn't normal. We're heading towards a crisis, and these people are taking action, so we can too.
How do you address the psychology of this? You mentioned the hourglass, time is running out, and that can lead to a sense of hopelessness. There's nothing we can do about it. Relatedly, you know, the problem of climate change seems so enormous and so challenging that it was just so much easier to turn the page and think about something else. So how do you address that psychology in the broad public of people who are just either indifferent to or actually defending themselves against tremendous anxiety about what we face?
Yeah, well, I'm a writer, and I write a lot about climate grief and climate anxiety. And I think the problem, if you're just one person, it is too overwhelming. You think, I can't do anything. The structures are all set against me. My little action won't actually solve for this, so I'm just going to move on with my day. And sometimes that fear can calcify into defense and into denial. So the goal of Extinction Rebellion is, you know, we believe that people know that something is wrong. Whatever part of their day is affected, they know that the days are getting hotter. They know that storms are more frequent. They can see that there aren't as many birds out and about. They can feel the consequences, right? But they feel alone. So the goal of Extinction Rebellion is to say, you can't solve this problem on your own, but if we build a mass movement of people, we can solve it together. And we're taking a page from the playbooks of past social movements to say, we actually don't need every single person. People who study rebellion and uprising say you need about 3% of the population, so we can get that. And if we get those people acting together, there's a feeling of power and even joy and hope. That's not the same kind of false hope that I think we're being peddled by a lot of our leaders, but a real hope that humans acting together in concert in a big movement demanding bold solutions and truth-telling can actually get this done. And so as an individual, you know, I've done a lot of environmental and climate organizing and activism, and I burned out because a lot of the groups around me were refusing to tell the truth about the scale of the crisis and were refusing to actually galvanize people into bolder, braver actions that we would need. So I got really burnt out, and I only got involved in climate activism again when Extinction Rebellion came around because I was so inspired by their basic premise of we need to tell the truth and act at the scale of the problem together.
When you say 3%, you mean people who are really seriously active on the issue and not just sympathizing, right?
Exactly.
And so what is the strategy? I mean, what's the disruption supposed to do?
We are basically trying to push climate change out of dinner table conversations or conversations behind closed doors at climate summits or in politicians' offices and into the streets. And the reason that we want to do that is because we believe that people know that this is a problem. They just aren't seeing people talking about it in an honest way and doing something about it. So our strategy is to engage in direct action and civil disobedience in public places so that people can see there is a group doing something about this. There is a demand to tell the truth. You can get involved. And also to target various institutions that contribute to or help with, you know, aid and abet the denial of the scope of the problem. So whether that's targeting media institutions that aren't telling the full truth about the climate crisis, or whether that's targeting fossil fuel infrastructures or banks that fund fossil fuel projects. It's basically to target the problem publicly and bravely and boldly, and to do civil disobedience and disrupt business as usual until our leaders commit to changing business as usual.
Social theorists like the great Francis Fox Piven say that the only way movements can really gain some traction is by disrupting business as usual, make it impossible for the society to reproduce itself in its normal fashion. Now, is that what you're aiming for, or just sort of attention-getting PR actions?
No, definitely the Francis Fox Piven version. We are disrupting not because we love getting in the way of people's commutes to work or chaining ourselves to things. We're disrupting because the society that we were born into, that I was born into, is not sustainable. If we continue on this track, we are facing ecological collapse, and we are facing a complete change to civilization as we know it. So we are trying to do targeted strategic disruptions so that we can change our course voluntarily as a society, instead of having that change foisted upon us by Mother Nature, which will not be pretty.
And what are you calling for exactly?
So our demands are pretty simple. First, we are demanding that the government tell the truth about climate change. And second, we're demanding that we get to net zero emissions by 2025. And third, we're demanding that the government convene citizens' assemblies to actually help implement those and track those policies that will actually reverse the problem. And we're doing that because governments can get up on stages, you know, leaders can get up on stages and bluster about how they're doing so well about, you know, tackling this problem of climate change. But this isn't an ego or a vanity project. This is about the numbers around actual survival. And right now, people tracking countries around the world that committed to, you know, the Paris Climate Agreement put the U.S. and several other countries in the critically insufficient category. We are on track for 3, 4, 5 degrees warming at our current rate, and that means possibly the extinction of the human species as we know it, definitely the extinction of millions of animal species. So we need to tell the truth about the full scale of the project, and all of our accounting needs to be done. All of our decisions need to be done with that in mind. And that's why we're calling for net zero emissions by 2025. World leaders have a long and sordid history of saying they're going to do something about it and not doing something about climate at all. So we're demanding rapid, immediate action, because the scientists and experts have told us we have 10 years to turn this around.
You're facing opposition not just from the cretins around Trump, you know, people like that who just want to expand offshore drilling at this moment, but also, you know, there's a kind of liberal environmentalism. Goldman Sachs, corporate liberal environmentalism. Goldman Sachs, for example, claims to be carbon neutral. Even News Corp, Rupert Murdoch's company, claims to be carbon neutral. How do you deal with that kind of pseudo-action on the part of the liberal establishment?
Yeah, I think that elites of all kinds are terrified by climate change and even more terrified about people rising up to solve it. Because when you rise up to solve climate change, you're not just demanding fewer parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. You're demanding system change. You're demanding changes to the economic foundations of our country. You're demanding changes to the political foundations of our country. You're demanding real democracy and change to every industrial sector you can imagine. So they're afraid of it. So, of course, they're going to come back and say, oh, but we installed low-flow water spigots in our bathrooms, or we did this and that. But if you just look at the numbers, that action is not enough. Individual action is not enough. Institutional action is even not enough. We need global structural overhaul of our systems to actually survive into the next century.
I understand Extinction Rebellion as an organization does have an opinion, but what do you and your colleagues think of the Green New Deal?
So our tactic is essentially to be a megaphone to declare climate emergency so that all these different groups that are pushing for more specific policies can get their jobs done easily and better and more quickly, essentially. So I think that fusing the environmental movement with the labor movement and talking about climate justice is one of the most essential things that we can do going forward. Vulnerable communities, people of color and poor communities have been most impacted and will be most impacted by climate change. So to solve for climate change, we have to have policies that integrate justice for poor people, justice for people of color, justice for animals, and justice for all humans. That has to be entwined. So I think that the Green New Deal is an essential part of doing that. We're trying to push the timeline so that we can do those sweeping changes even more quickly than what is currently politically imaginable.
And what's happening in the rest of the country beyond New York City with Extinction Rebellion?
So there are, you know, dozens of countries around the world that have signed up and are part of Extinction Rebellion and have been hosting demonstrations, cities all over the United States, you know, L.A., Chicago, Portland, Minneapolis, all these different places are hosting Extinction Rebellion events. Just the other day, L.A. Extinction Rebellion activists glued themselves to the Universal Studios Golden Globe and demanded that NBC cover climate change as the emergency that it is. Portland activists brought in huge piles of dirt and our soil and are building a garden across a fossil fuel transport lines that will create even more carbon emissions in that area. So people everywhere are basically rising up and saying, we're part of an international movement that's calling for three very simple things. But in our communities, we can figure out who are the fossil fuel polluters, who's the problem, and how can we creatively target those polluting industries and those aiders and abettors of climate chaos and actually call for climate sanity.
And I'm not asking you to blow any secrets, but what do you have planned for the future?
So we'll just be continuing to do increasing and escalating direct actions around the city, again, targeting the sources of the problem, both in the media and in the financial and energy sectors. But we're also demanding that the city council in New York City declare a climate emergency. And that's a strategy that people are using all over the world. That's part of the truth telling, right? Is that governments on all levels from local to federal need to tell the truth. So for us, that means the New York City council needs to declare a climate emergency and commit to reducing fossil fuel emissions to net zero by 2025. And we want them to pass that so that every other project that comes before them on their desks, they have to evaluate in terms of that climate emergency. And we've actually made a lot of strides, and we're hoping to get that introduced in the next month.
And then finally, people are listening and want to get involved. What should they do?
they can join us in New York City, or they can join anywhere in the country where there's a group, or if they don't have a group in their area, they can start a group. You can go to rebellion.earth and you can find out if there's a chapter in your city. In New York City, you can follow us on Facebook at Extinction Rebellion New York City and on Twitter at XR_NYC, same thing for Instagram, and you can get in touch with us through any of those sites and sign up to be part of one of our teams. We have outreach teams, media teams, action planning teams, the whole nine yards. So yeah, we want more people, we need more people, and we need more brave people who are willing to put their bodies on the line. So we encourage people to come out and get involved.
That was Ashley Sanders, who's on the outreach team for Extinction Rebellion New York City. She gave electronic addresses for the New York City chapter. For national info, visit extinctionrebellion.us. I admire these people so much. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of musical hope, some of the last movement of Mahler's Resurrection Symphony performed by the Vienna Philharmonic under Pierre Boulez. Till next week, bye.